Catherine Austin Fitz, thank you so much for doing this. I have a lot of questions. I'll keep them short. Are we experiencing inflation in the United States, do you believe?
Yes, we are experiencing inflation, and there is a reasonable chance that the inflation, at least the increase in household goods, is going to get much, much worse.
Why?
So it is because we've been going through a restructuring of the economy for many decades. This has been building for many decades. One, we start off with a model where we have a debt-based currency, and that debt-basing forces huge expenses that you don't have to have. That's number one. But number two, we've run our fiscal economy in ways that I would describe as a financial coup d'etat. And as we've pulled resources out of the economy, we have consolidated ownership and control in a way that forces expenses, or it lowers the income for the general population, and it raises their expenses. And this has been a intentional consolidation of ownership and control. And now you're seeing the results that result in people being squeezed in a variety of ways. So I'm describing a change in the financial model, this centralization of power and economic control. And it involves many different things throughout the economy. But the important thing to understand is it was a plan. It's intentional. And if you look at where we are, it's going to take many, many things to change it, because it comes with tremendous and explosive changes in technology, which can be used to create great prosperity, but can also be used to consolidate control in a way that benefits the few and destroy the many.
So as I hear your big picture description of this transition through which we're moving, the first thought that comes to mind is, boy, that sounds a little bit like what happened after the Soviet Union collapsed in the summer of 1991. And all of a sudden, Russians woke up 10 years later and all state industries were owned by a small group of people. It was
correct.
That's kind of what it sounds like.
Well, I'm grossly oversimplifying, but if you look at the people who did it's called the Rape of Russia.
Yes.
You know, it's a similar group. And I'll give you a story. I was in the City of London making a presentation in 2001, and I'd been asked to speak about what I call piratization in the United States, the consolidation of the real estate and housing market. So I'd been the Assistant Secretary of Housing. And I gave the presentation, and two presentations followed, one by Ann Williamson, who had been covering Russia for the Wall Street Journal during the Rape of Russia. And she got up and gave a presentation. And then John Laughlin, who's a remarkable British commentator now in Paris, stood up and did the same on what had happened in Eastern Europe. And the three of us went into shock, as did many of the investors in the room, because we realized it was the same firms, the same law firms, the same intelligence agencies, and what they were doing in Eastern Europe and in Russia and in the United States was a very similar game. We have a big presentation in Slurry called Plunder. But they were basically going in and plundering, and it was one plan. It wasn't three different plans or three different groups. It was a process of consolidation of the economies in all three places.
And basically a privatization of the nation's resources.
Well, here's the thing. Privatization, Tucker, is when I transfer an asset or involve corporations in a service at a market price. Piratization is when I transfer an asset to a private party at 10 cents on the dollar.
Yes.
So at a below market price. And what we've been watching by and large around the world is piratization, not privatization, or plunder.
The looting. And thank you for that distinction, because it seems important. So it's not simply a matter. So I think many of us on the right were sold on the idea that government is inefficient, which is an easy case to make because it's true. And in order to make the system, the government, more efficient, we need to privatize things, and the public benefits and the market rules apply. And so it's fair and transparent, and it just works better. That is the case, I think, that free market economists made throughout the 80s and 90s.
So it's so funny. I wrote a piece about this sort of piratization at the time, And it later became an online book I wrote called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. And when I first sent it to the, I was working with this firm in London, the head of research just started laughing. And he said, I've always believed that government is inefficient and the solution is to bring in more private, you know, more private capacity. And he said, I'm reading this. And what I realize is, you know, what is going on is the private guys are just using the government to pay themselves huge and hideous profits above market in a way that's destroying markets. So we have these public-private partnerships that involve huge corruption, huge grift, and aren't productive at all. But the spin they use is the what you just described.
Boy, it's a very effective argument, and it certainly fooled me. Definitely fooled me. So how does that trend that you just described cause inflation?
So for example, and there are thousands of different examples, but one of the things that drive prices up is when you have consolidation into monopolies or duopolies. And so if the Department of Justice is simply not enforcing antitrust, you're going to get consolidation and monopoly pricing. The best example, of course, is the bailouts. So according to the Levy Institute, there were $29 trillion on the bailouts. And what did we see? We saw a group of financial institutions engage in massive mortgage fraud and financial fraud. As a result, we had $29 trillion of bailings, which does run up the debt quite a certain amount. And then what happens? They get the benefit of more access to the federal credit, all sorts of special dispensations. And coming out of the financial crisis, they have a major, much bigger market share, right?
Yeah.
So not only did they get $29 trillion of bailouts, but suddenly they shifted their market share up dramatically in a way that gives them monopoly pricing power. Okay. And so, you know, and that was combined, for example, in the financial area with changing the laws in 79, 80 to allow essentially usury. So for example, when I went from a process of being a multimillionaire to having a very rich cash flow every month to having to live on $2,000 a month and run my companies with that on the $2,000. And when things are really desperate, I used to always get a credit card in the mail from JP Morgan Chase for $300, with a $50 sign up fee and then 30% interest rate. And it was, you're in the corner. You know, according to the Department of Justice, you have to be in Washington in 2 days, and suddenly you magically get this credit card, which will finance your trip for 50% interest rates when you combine in the fee.
So this is when you were being assailed, prosecuted by the Department of Justice after you left government yourself.
Yeah. So I had a company, Hamilton Securities Group, which was working as the lead financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And we were essentially responsible for making sure portfolio strategy was done properly, as well as doing loan sales. And we were essentially stopping money from disappearing out of the back door of HUD. And so to get rid of us, we were targeted in this process. And interestingly enough, after they did get rid of us and the public officials we were working with, suddenly massive amounts of money started disappearing from the HUD financial systems. And, you know, it's typical in government. You've got to get the honest people out if you're going to grift in a major, major way. And that's what happened anyway. But we had 18 audits and investigations, 12 tracks of litigation, a smear campaign, and physical harassment. And the goal, of course, was to catch us doing something, was to prove that we had done something wrong. And it got very, it went on for a long time because they could never prove anything. And they tried to falsify documentation. We caught them, you know, and then it turned into a very long process. So, and ultimately we won the big litigation. So we were able to win. And one of the reasons I refused to settle and insisted on going to, you know, because they try and keep you out of court. I couldn't get into court. It really started in 95. I couldn't get into court on the main case until 2004. So they try and keep you out of court because, of course, they have no evidence of any wrongdoing. And it was very funny, Tucker. I wish I had a video of it on the Three times they canceled on the eve of trial. So my lawyers were the most overprepared people in the world. They were being paid by the insurance company. And so we got to the final, the first day of the final trial, and I wouldn't settle. And I kept, you know, insisting. And they constantly, I was poisoned many times when I wouldn't settle because they wanted to sort of exhaust me. Anyway, I come in on the last trial on the first day, and essentially the other side has nothing. They have absolutely nothing. And all the lawyers on the other side are fighting. It's the whistleblower attorney and the Department of Justice attorney and the HUD attorney. They're all fighting. And at the end of the day, my attorney turns to me and he's white as a sheet and he says, "Oh my God, they had absolutely nothing."
But at the depth of this, when you had no money and you're trying to run everything, your life and business on $2,000 a month, you're getting credit card offers from JP Morgan Chase. And that's kind of a metaphor for the entire how the entire economy works, right? It's
right.
People profiting off desperation.
So I live in one of the first things I did is I sold my big mansion in Washington and bought a country home in Hickory Valley, Tennessee. And I moved to Hickory Valley, Tennessee. I have cousins who are cotton farmers in Hickory Valley, Tennessee. And I moved to Hickory Valley, Tennessee because I knew that the cost of living was much, much lower. And so the county I live in Tennessee has a per capita income of $24,000 a year. Yeah, very, very low income. And one of the things when I, as soon as I moved there, what I realized is we were targeted for predatory lending by all the big banks and lenders. And so one of the ways I used to entertain myself, you know, I was trained on Wall Street and I was trained by the top, some of the best lawyers on Wall Street, how to negotiate. It was really fun for me because I would pick up the phone and they would just assume I was another person with $24,000 a year income, which, you know, and $2,000 a month I was. And so I would start to ask them about their offers and negotiate with them. And I learned all their tricks. And what was amazing to me is the people in my county were targeted by some of the smartest legal stratagems I've ever dealt with in my life. You know, but it was war. It was a financial onslaught of trying to trick people into debt. Of course, debt is one of the greatest ways you can destroy a family's finances, addiction and debt. And if you look at the targeting of American communities during that period, they were specifically targeted with both addiction and debt. And it was an onslaught. And I got to learn a lot about it living there.
What do you think the purpose was? Why would any American want to destroy an American community and kill people and enslave them with debt?
So if I want to change the economy and I want to change it from a democratic republic to essentially an oligarchy, then what I need to do is I need to consolidate wealth, and I need to reduce the general population to a group of people who are much easier to control. So let me go back. In 1995, there was an effort made by the people who I would describe as leading the financial system to try and put the country on a financially sound basis. And it failed and ended up at the end of 1995 in a 3-week shutdown of the government. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes,
it was during the Clinton administration.
Well.
And it was described to me by the president of the largest pension fund in the country several years later. He said, "You don't understand. They've given up. They've given up on the country and they're moving all the money out starting in the fall." And that was when the $21 trillion started to go missing, you know, compounded by the $29 trillion that went out on the bailouts. I think what happened was when they failed to achieve a fiscally responsible approach to the federal balance sheet, that they decided to do two things. One, they decided to do a financial coup in a process where instead of the bankers just running monetary policy, they could then run fiscal policy. And I think the second thing they decided to do is if you can't balance the budget with financial responsibility, you can balance the budget by lowering life expectancy. So if you can't fund the pension and retirement system with enough money to meet your obligations, you can meet your obligations by lowering life expectancy. And I think a conscious decision was made to do that. That literally right after the budget deal sort of busted, two decisions were made. One was to approve OxyContin and open the pill mills. The second was all sorts of policies that permitted HUD and other mortgage predatory lending. And that happened right as they also made the decision to do the private prisons, and they kept flooding the neighborhoods with drugs. And if you look at the combination of the pill mills, the predatory lending, narcotics trafficking coming in, again, this is all covered in my online book. You know, it dramatically started to steadily reduce life expectancy, particularly in the lower income groups. And I knew it was coming. One of the reasons I kept talking with everybody about the missing money is I knew that it would hit the middle income groups. It was just a matter of time. And I remember I always tell the story of talking to Dr. Mark Skidmore, who had worked with me on the missing money. I was sitting in a car in Bolivar, Tennessee. I was doing errands. And he kept saying to me, why do you keep bringing up all the money that's going missing from the federal government? Why don't you give up on this? And I said, don't you understand, Mark, if we don't do something about this, they're going to take radical steps of lowering life expectancy. And that was in 2018. And of course, you know, COVID hit in 2020. And what did we get? We got a whole series of actions that continued to lower life expectancy, but this time in the middle and upper middle class groups.
It's so obvious to me that reducing population, either through shortening their lives or preventing them from being born in the first place, I mean, that's official U.S. policy, of course.
Right.
Abortion, euthanasia, drugs. But I've always sort of wondered why. And you think it's because that's the only way to get the country solvent?
So I think it's a combination of things. First of all, you have... again, we have this explosive new technology, and I think you have a lot of people in the leadership who believe, first of all, it's very difficult to manage people, particularly if they get their hands on this technology, but they also believe they're going to live for a long, long time. You know, Jared Kushner, when he left the first Trump administration, did a podcast and said, I'm the first generation to live forever, the last generation to, you know, not live forever. Sean Parker, one of the co-founders of Facebook, said, I'm a billionaire, so I'm going to live to 145. If the oligarchs are going to live to 145, one of the things they know is not everybody can do that, or you're going to have an environmental problem, right? Right. So part of it is that. But I also think with robotics and automation, they think they don't need a lot of people, and a lot of people are hard to manage.
Yes.
Now, they... you know, they, if you look at what they're doing to build a control grid, clearly they think if they can accomplish that, it's going to make it much easier to manage a lot of people. But frankly, they don't necessarily want them around. They don't need them. And so I do believe that many of them feel they would be much better off with much lower populations.
I think that's obviously true. May I ask, though, about what role a global war would play in that? So, like, on the one hand, obviously, war reduces population. And if you wanted to clear the Ukrainians out of Ukraine, leaving only the resources and Indian right. immigrants, you would do what they are doing. I get it. But once you start pushing up against the possibility of a nuclear exchange, a total war, a global war, then don't you, and which they are doing knowingly and I don't know if it's reckless or intentional or what exactly it is, but they know that we're moving toward global war and they're not slowing down, the Trump administration and all the people who support it.
Right.
Don't you kind of risk your own plans by doing that? That seems very much like a dice roll.
So there are a couple theories. I think there's some people who, you know, do want to bring on Armageddon. That's a cultural and religious cross-section of some of the people involved. But the other thing is, if you've been responsible for the dollar system and you know how dangerous an improper or a difficult unraveling of the dollar system could be for most of the countries around the world, you know how an unraveling could kill and hurt and maim then you will go to extreme lengths and kill many, many people to avoid that. You know, and part of it is if you're used to having power, you do not want to convert to a meritocracy. I mean, right. The way to solve, you know, I just told you the thing you just did on how to save America, I think is one of the best things you've ever done. And if in theory, we all woke up tomorrow and followed your 10 principles of, you know, in our own lives, in our own family, in our own community, we could see an unbelievably explosive wealth creation. I mean, one of the things I want to stress is tyranny is very, very wasteful. And the potential for wealth explosion, if we could somehow, you know, behave like we were an advanced civilization, is an extraordinary opportunity. But it's going to result in a meritocracy. And if you look at the people running things, they have no interest in competing in a meritocracy.
Yes.
Because they're going to lose, right?
Yeah.
And the nature of their situation is, you know, when people in their situation lose, they get killed and their families get killed. So, you know, they are at the point where they would do control. I remember one group telling me about a group during the 80s when Iran-Contra was really getting out of hand, talking about they had started to make plans about exploding a suitcase nuke in the middle of Chicago, you know, just to distract. Remember, one of the goals of war is to control the domestic population. And we are now approaching a time where whether you get you have a war, or you get the control grid, controlling the domestic population is going to be very difficult.
So won't that control grid make it easier?
Yeah, if they can get it. Yeah. If they can put it into place. So, I mean, let's look at what they're hoping to do. What they're hoping to do, first of all, is to use stable coins and digital tokens to bring 4 billion people around the world, and this is the retail market, into the treasury market and into the U.S. stock and bond market, and literally take the U.S. market share, for example, in the stock market, up from 70% to 90% of the global stock market. So they're hoping to essentially tender for all the citizens in the world and bring them into our financial system. You know, that what they've said is we're going to do 24/7 trading on the global stock markets using digital tokens, and we're going to offer 20 times margin. You know, everybody right now is really worried about we're in a bubble. If you look at the tools that are being amassed to bubble using crypto, I mean, arguably, if they succeed, and I'm not saying that they will, but if they do, it'll be the biggest bubble I've ever seen. And I've lived through a lot of bubbles. So, you know, you bring another 4 billion people into the U.S. currency, the U.S. bond market, the U.S. stock market, you know, and you do it with 24/7 trading with 20 times margin. It's going to be extraordinary because those are networks you can also pump out more debt on.
Yeah.
Right. So now what's interesting is the Clarity Act, it appears, is not going to pass this year, which was one of the sort of legal infrastructures they wanted to do this. So I find the sort of the potential crash and burn this fall of the Clarity Act to be quite remarkable. Okay. So they think through these mechanisms, they have tools that can consider this wave and this bubble going forward. Now, if you look at what they want to do, what they want to do is put on your currency, your bank deposits, and your stocks and bonds what I call a manual, an automatic third lock. Do you know what a third lock is?
No.
Okay, let me describe this. If you and I do a transaction and I want to buy a Tucker Carlson hat, and you want to sell it to me, I give you cash, I get the hat. That's a two-lock transaction. You have a lock, I have a lock. If one of us says no, it can't happen, okay? Let's say we have money in the bank, and I want to buy the hat. I'm going to transfer money. I'll do an ACH to you for the cost of the hat. The bank has rules from the Treasury Department. It has sanctions. It has to know your customer rules. It has other regulations. And it has the ability to intercede and stop the transaction for those reasons, okay? And that's a sort of what I call a manual third lock. So the bank gets a third lock implementing the government regulations. And so if you look at what happened to the truckers in Canada, they had all, not all, but most of the banks exercised that manual third lock under the direction of the government. What the government wants to do, and what the Treasury and the central banks want, is they want an automatic third lock. So you don't have to go through the bank. And not only can you apply sanctions and know your customer and money laundering laws, you can apply a full-blown social credit system, right? So I can make up a hugely complex rule system for Tucker and his kids and his grandkids. I can customize it for each one of you, and I can give you incentives, and I can give you rules. And unless you do exactly what I say, I can turn off your money, or I can apply negative interest rates to your money, or positive interest rates. I can raise your taxes without anybody having any say about it. So let me give you an example. Go back to the pandemic. If I say you're locked down and you and your family can't leave your house, your money won't work outside your house if I have an all digital system with an automatic third lock. And let's say I freeze your bank account. You can't go to your bank and talk to them. It's above their head. They won't be implementing it. Okay. That gives them, that's what the data centers are for. That's what the AI is for, at least in North America. You know, the goal of that, because if you look at spatial control, it involves tremendous data because of the videos and the cameras, and you've got lots of video footage. But then you can imagine financial transactions all over the world. If they're going to bring 4 billion customers from around the world into the dollar markets or our stock market, that's a huge amount of data for spatial and financial control. But with AI, what is AI great at? AI is fabulous at processing enormous amounts of mathematical information, which is most of the information, the data we're talking about. And so if they can put a manual third lock in a social credit system for every individual and essentially automate the whole process with AI, then they have the ability, in fact, to control many, many people. Now, here's the question. Why would 4 billion people want to come into that system? It's very interesting. The Secretary of the Treasury during the, was I think about a month or two ago, said, you know, they'd seized $1 billion of Iranian wallets. And he was bragging about how easy it was to do it. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not sure if you're going to go out and try and persuade 4 billion people to come into our markets that you really want to have them realize that we can seize their wallets with that kind of speed and ease.
No, that would be a disincentive to participation. There's no doubt about it.
I think so.
May I ask you, just since we're on markets, and I don't want to get sidetracked, but I think you might be able to answer this. I'm baffled by the behavior of various commodities markets. Since mm-hmm. this war began, they've moved in the opposite direction from what you would expect if supply and demand was real. So let's just start with oil prices, Brent crude, use that as a measure. They've right. not gone straight up, and they've kind of gone up and down, but not very up, in some cases down.
Right.
And I think we can say part of that is because China decided to stop its energy imports, which is bizarre behavior. And then gold has also, I mean, since this spring has dropped $1,000 an ounce at exactly the moment when the U.S. dollar is clearly headed to a much weaker position. So that doesn't make any sense at all. Is it possible?
That makes a lot of sense.
It does. Tell me how.
So let's look at oil first. So the Chinese have done a remarkable job of just cutting their imports in half. And to me, there's not a lot of reliable information about, we know they've built a lot of nuclear capacity and renewable capacity. They say, the last time I looked, they say they're not using their oil reserves, which are significant, is my understanding. But, you know, it's hard to believe they haven't. The Japanese had a fair amount of oil reserves. They've run down their reserves. My understanding is our reserves are now below the amount, you know, that threatens the whole infrastructure of the strategic reserve, which is frightening. But we've run our reserves down tremendously. So part of what's been happening in the oil market is I suspect that the the shorting and the things they do to manage the price, if manage the price down. But that's combined with enormous relief of pressure on the market because of what the Chinese did and because of ours and the Japanese strategic reserve. Now, but if you look at the U.S. strategy is designed to replace the petrodollar with what some people call the petrogas dollar. And between bottlenecking the trade routes and sabotaging energy capacity all over the world, they're trying to build a much bigger market share for U.S. LNG. Remember, we're a net exporter now. And if you look at how much LNG, for example, we're selling into Asia, you know, our oil and gas industry is making a lot of money. Now, the question is, now that the war is continuing and we don't have the Japanese and U.S. reserves to run down a lot, there's a real expectation that the price could continue to go higher. Now, here's the other thing, Tucker. When you shut down, when you do what's been done to the global economy since February, you create a lot of inflation, deflation, because you are shutting down. I call this COVID 2.0. You're wiping out a lot of little guys, and it consolidates into the big guys. But this is very depressing for the global economy, right? And that's deflationary. Now, let me talk about gold. You know, ever since I started covering gold in, say, 2000 and on, whenever there's a war kind of situation, you see gold drop. It's very typical. And one of the reasons is people get short and they have to sell their gold. But the other is people want liquidity. So they go into treasuries, they go into the short-term bond market, even if the dollar's weak. So they're looking to go to cash, so to speak, and you'll see them leave gold. So it doesn't surprise me that probably a lot of people in the Gulf area and globally needed to sell gold. But gold's in a long-term bull market, and this is just, you know, this is the normal volatility of gold in these kinds of situations.
May I ask, why would China slash its oil imports and import as much gold as it has, which is a lot? Why is China importing gold and not
buying oil?
That
is an excellent question. And I don't know why. I suspect they think they have the nuclear and renewable and other capacity to do that for some period of time. I mean, clearly Venezuela, you know, cut them, and clearly the situation has cut them. But I think that's a big question mark. And one of the reasons might be, you know, they understood that it was very important to, you know, let that Steve Valve. They're helping the global economy tremendously. If the price was running up, you know, where many people thought it would go, the pain in the global economy would be absolutely enormous.
Yeah. I mean, you could easily see $7 a gallon gasoline in the U.S. And yeah. But I guess what I'm saying is, it seems like the Chinese government has done the Trump administration a huge favor by keeping things kind of status quo when they wouldn't normally be.
Yes. That is absolutely correct. And if you look at the who's purchasing what in Asia, the U.S. is clearly making a lot of money exporting LNG to Asia. This has been very, very good for the U.S. oil and gas industry.
So my last question has to do with attitudes, and I'm confused by this, and you may have an answer. So consumer prices have risen. Inflation is real. It's the product of long-term changes, the ones you just described, but it's also the product of this war of choice begun at the end of February. That's all. It's obvious. Anybody can understand it without an economics degree. Prices of food have gone up. That's detectable to everybody because everybody eats. Somebody notes this the other day and says, gee whiz, you know, $20 burritos are a lot. And immediately the same people, many of them who advocated for this war of choice, attack anyone who complains about rising food prices. And what I see there is like pure contempt, if not hatred, for ordinary people. Like, what else could explain that kind of response? But I also see a kind of crazy recklessness, because normally in a functioning society with normal motives, the people in charge, the rich people, don't make fun of the poor people for overpaying for food, because that's dangerous. Like, they could rise up and bite you if you keep mocking them. The let them eat cake thing doesn't work as a long-term strategy. Why are they doing that? Why are they showing contempt for the population?
So I think they think the best defense is a good offense.
Huh.
And they're attacking people for being lazy or not working. And they describe how they made it to where they are. And,
right.
You know, it's simply what psychopaths do.
Yes.
I mean, here's the thing. And I'll just be blunt. One of the things, you know, we had many people on our network all excited about the new administration, and they participated in MAHA groups and worked very hard to do everything they could to get Washington to change its policies. And one of the great things about watching what has happened, because it's in most respects, it's completely gone the other way, is it's proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is a bipartisan commitment to depopulation.
Yes.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful scientist on the other day who has been very instrumental in trying to stop the liability shield for pesticides. And she got to the end of the show, and you could see she was frustrated. She's a very careful scientist, very thorough. And she said, so she really wanted to get her point across. She said, you have to understand that if this liability shield happens and they do what they say they're going to do, if they get it, I consider that as a scientist to be an extinction level event, given the impact on female fertility. You know, it was a showstopper. And so if you look at the policies coming through the sausage factory in Washington, these are intentional policies to depopulate. An enormous effort has been made for almost my entire lifetime to come up with any strategy that can obfuscate or stop people from seeing the obvious. And something marvelous is happening, Tucker. And what is marvelous, and it's the first time in my lifetime I've seen it, that people are finally saying, oh, you know, they really are trying to kill us. And that's very freeing, because once you know it, you know to get as far away from them as possible and protect yourself. And the thing that's very healthy about it, and one of the reasons I loved your, you know, 10 principles to save America, real solutions come when we let go. When we let go of hoping that there's some way we can go into that machinery and turn it around, it's not going to work. So we need to leave. We need to get away from the diseased animal and go do things that can work. And if enough of us do that, what is possible is absolutely fantastic. The little secret here is if you look at that machinery, it is so destructive of wealth at the state and local level that if we could begin to reverse it, even 5% or 10%, you don't need everybody. The possibilities are enormous, particularly with the blessing of new technology. So it doesn't have to go bad here. It can be transformative. But what it requires is we've got to stop hoping, you know, that the people who would, you know, attack you for a $20 burrito. I mean, seriously, can anybody take Ben Shapiro seriously ever again?
No.
So no, we need to laugh. We need to laugh. We need to just laugh and turn it off, right? It's a joke. He's not serious. He's not relevant.
That is the most, that's the most hopeful thing I've heard in a long time. Catherine Austin Fitz. No, I think you have obviously deep knowledge, but also a beautiful perspective. So thank you very much for sharing it.
Thank you, Tucker.